supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Nina Feldman, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. After their encampment was torn down at 8th and Cherry Streets, immigration policy protesters today moved to City Hall. Their objective now is to pressure Mayor Jim Kenney to end a controversial contract giving immigration officials access to a real-time arrest database. Kenney says he welcomes the protesters, but he's being cautious about ending the contract. WHYY's Daryl C. Murphy has more.
The protesters who want to abolish the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement are now focusing their efforts on ending ICE's access to what's called the Preliminary Arraignment Reporting System. Since their first encampment was cleared out by police, some of those protesters are changing their strategy by focusing on City Hall. Brian, who declined to give his last name, says the activists plan to stay put for as long as it takes.
We're going to be here as long as that is the law. We're going to have a presence here. I think it's really important for the council to remember that it's election season coming up, and it's really a great opportunity for them to show who they really care about in their constituency and really stand up for the immigrant communities.
Mayor Jim Kenney says removing the protesters from the original location was to prevent a repeat of Occupy Philly. In 2011, hundreds of demonstrators were evacuated from Dilworth Plaza after camping there for weeks. More than 50 people were arrested, and the city settled a $200,000 lawsuit with protesters who claimed their civil rights were violated. Kenney says the protesters are welcome at a corner outside City Hall as long as they don't block entrances or threaten public safety.
The protesters, I admire the fact that they're dedicated to ending this. They're outraged at the way children have been treated at the border. I am outraged at the way the children have been treated at the border, and I want them to continue to protest.
77-year-old Gobi is one of the protesters at City Hall and was part of the 2011 Occupy demonstration from the beginning to the end. He says he doesn't trust Kenny's reason and says he is an ICE enabler.
Because he prevented people from really stopping the use of that ICE facility. The words that he showered out about no encampments and following the law, as far as I'm concerned, just BS.
In June, a federal judge found that the U.S. withholding a crime-fighting grant because of the city's sanctuary status was unconstitutional. The feds can still appeal, and Kenney doesn't want to risk a reversal of the ruling. He's considering that as he weighs his decision on whether to end or renew the contract ending August 31st.
I want to make sure with our city solicitor that we're stepping forward in a positive way in protecting that order, which is very important nationally. I mean, it's one of those orders that affect everyone nationally. So we don't want to do anything that's going to rile the appellate court necessarily and reverse the judge's decision. But that doesn't mean we won't end it.
Kenney says he is willing to speak with protest leaders on the immigration issues. For WHYY, Daryl C. Murphy.
Right now, the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar says there are up to 3,000 children that have been separated from their families at the border and not reunited. In total, there are almost 12,000 unaccompanied minors in the custody of U.S. government. Psychiatrist Craig Ginsburg works with The Village, a Philadelphia nonprofit that provides residential and behavioral health services to kids and families. He joins us now to provide insight about potential psychological impacts on the children of immigrants. Dr. Ginsburg, thank you for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We hear a lot about trauma that young people are likely to experience in the process of being separated from their parents. Can you describe what exactly that means and what it might look like?
I think most of your listeners would probably find it hard to imagine being separated from parents. I think a lot of us, when we were younger, if we've had the misfortune to be separated briefly, say at the mall for a half an hour, that was a very traumatic event and something that was probably talked about for quite some time. To then have to imagine being separated from your family, caretakers, loved ones, extended relatives for a prolonged or even possibly permanent period of time is really almost unimaginable. Luckily, over the last 30 years or so, I think that we as a society and mental health professionals specifically have learned from our advances as well as some setbacks on how to work with children and young adolescents and older adolescents who have been traumatized. It's not unusual for the child or adolescent to become very, very anxious. This, in my opinion, can be misidentified as an attention problem, you know, whether it's labeled as attention deficit disorder or some other such thing. Recently, over the past 6 to 7 months, I've been dealing with a younger child. He's a little bit below the age of 10. And initially, the referral came because the child's school had concerns. The child's grades were decreasing. They appeared to be not paying attention. Some of the teachers felt that the child was starting to give off some attitude. And I met with the child, and it soon became apparent that he did have significant impairment with focus and concentration. But the reason was he was very worried because his parents were illegally in the country, had been in the country for well over 10 years. But the concern was that with the changes in different regulations and laws, that they could be deported at a moment's notice. This young child also felt the burden that he may have to take care of his younger siblings.
So in this case, and more broadly, how would you approach treatment? If a child who had been separated from his parent were brought into your office, what would you do?
Well, initially, you want to get as much information as is available. And sometimes the information can be pretty complete, and sometimes it can be minimal. I mean, there are situations, unfortunately, where a child could present for an evaluation, and the person accompanying them is simply a driver from some agency. The first thing you want to do is quickly evaluate safety and are the child's immediate needs being met. You then want to assess, are they ready to do the trauma work? If you jump right into it, you could present some triggers or you could re-traumatize the person and make it very difficult or impossible for a prolonged period of time for them to be able to do the work.
We mentioned the number of almost 12,000 unaccompanied minors in the custody of the U.S. government right now, and the example that you mentioned of a young man who, you know, is in the custody of his parents but is in constant fear of them being deported. On a broader scale, are we creating a sort of hostile climate for the mental health of the next generation of immigrant children?
I don't know that I would use the word hostile, but I think no matter where these children ultimately settle, I think we're certainly not helping them with regard to the overall adjustment, overall happiness, being able to decrease their anxiety, helping to ensure they're sleeping and eating well. But we're also talking about the people that are going to be the parents of tomorrow. And you learn a lot from your parents. And if they grow up being suspicious and overly anxious, then what do they pass on to their children?
Thank you very much, Dr. Ginsberg.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Craig Ginsberg. He works with The Village here in Philadelphia, and he specializes in child and adolescent psychiatry. Over the past 20 years, Pennsylvania's two biggest cities have changed in very different ways when it comes to public schools. In Philadelphia, there's been a robust embrace of charter schools, and citywide, enrollment is steady. In Pittsburgh, there's been more skepticism of school choice, and enrollment keeps dropping. But what do these enrollment trends tell us, if anything, about education policy? Keystone Crossroads enlisted the help of two reporters, Sarah Schneider from WESA in Pittsburgh and Avi Wolfman-Arendt from WHYY in Philadelphia, to explore that very question. Avi starts us off.
Mike McGranahan grew up in Northeast Philadelphia, but he always assumed that he'd leave. The Northeast is one of the city's middle-class bedrocks and shares a border with two much wealthier counties.
My goal was always to actually move out to suburbia, you know, the McMansion push.
But McGranahan and his wife had three kids and over the years discovered that they really liked their home neighborhood. Then their oldest hit school age, and McGranahan started thinking about the burbs again. McGranahan didn't trust the city public schools. The test scores weren't good, and he didn't feel they were safe enough or well enough funded. Lots of other families in his area send their kids to Catholic school, but tuition for three was going to be steep. Then he learned about another option.
The charter school movement really took off, and I did a lot of research, and MAST became goal number one.
MAST is a charter school with really good test scores near McGranahan's neighborhood, just along the edge of the city.
That's what the hope and dream became. If we got MAST, we wouldn't have to consider leaving.
That was 2008, and you can probably guess the story from here. The McGranahan kids get into MAST. 10 years later, they're still living in Northeast Philly. And it's a textbook case of how a popular school can help keep people in a city. In Philadelphia, over the last 20 years, there's been a huge explosion of charter schools and magnet schools and other alternatives to neighborhood public school. And school choice advocates will tell you that all of these options have been a major boon to the city.
So we've actually seen evidence of that. That's not debatable or refutable. That's just the fact.
Anthony Hardy Williams is a state senator from Philly who helped pass Pennsylvania's charter law back in 1997. And he says the proof is in the population. In the back half of the 20th century,
there was a whole middle class that left, black and white. And now we've seen that really slow significantly.
It's true that Philadelphia's population decline has started to reverse, slightly. And since charters opened 20 years ago, the city's public school enrollment, charters and traditional schools combined, has remained about steady. But it's a different story in Pittsburgh, where my colleague Sarah Schneider is based.
The Steel City's population has plummeted 20% since 1990. After the mills closed in the 80s, people fled in hopes of other job opportunities. But now the story is revitalization. The city's economy is bouncing back, the median home value has increased while poverty is slowing, and tech jobs are bringing young people back. The city, though, is still reeling from population loss in many ways. Pittsburgh public school enrollment continues to decline, falling more than a quarter since the beginning of the century. Rebecca Lee is one of those who left. She and her husband built a home in a suburban development just 15 miles north of their first house in the city's north side.
We literally just moved in.
The nearby parks and the proximity to the downtown core were perks, but a main reason her family moved was to escape the city's school system.
The school that you feed into from the north side is very poorly rated.
When her oldest son was approaching kindergarten age, she started asking other parents where they sent their kids.
I don't think anybody sent their child to that school. They either were able to get their kid into one of the magnets, or they went private, or they moved.
Some say people like Rebecca Lee might have stayed if they had the type of choices available to Mike McGranahan. Pittsburgh has been more skeptical of charter schools than Philadelphia, and proportionally has far fewer. This bothers Pittsburgh charter supporter Rachel Amoncalor.
There are many charter school parents that I've spoken to who have said, if I hadn't gotten my child into the school, we would have left the city. And I think that's an interesting point in the difference in Pittsburgh and Philly, where you've seen much more drastic population decline in Pittsburgh than in Philadelphia, is I really think that the charter sector is keeping families within the city in a way that the charter sector here hasn't.
While this could be true in individual cases, some say it misses the bigger picture in both Philadelphia and Pittsburgh.
It's worth noting that charters in both cities serve an overwhelmingly poor and disproportionately black student body. And lots of the parents who choose them don't have the option, like Mike McGranahan, to leave. Donna Cooper is a former aide to Governor Ed Rendell and a longtime Philly-based education advocate.
In general, I'm not convinced that the children who are enrolled in charters are the children of families who had the capacity to move.
Cooper sees Philly's population trend more as a result of larger economic forces.
I feel personally like there's a little bit of a renaissance, and it's bigger than the schools. It's the sense that younger people want to live in cities.
And while Pittsburgh is having that renaissance too, it's still actually a very big win when families like the Lees decide to stay in the region and put down roots.
You know, when I was a kid, You drove into the city and you went by the Jones and Lachlan Mill that was belching fire and smoke and fumes 24 hours a day. And then it was gone.
David Thornburg grew up in Pittsburgh in the years before his dad, Dick Thornburg, became Pennsylvania's governor.
There is a very clear sense that, like, there was an economy here and now there isn't anymore. So there was much more urgency, I think, around that question than trying to take on the schools.
The Pittsburgh metro area has shrunk 4% since 2000. And Thornburg says people aren't necessarily leaving Pittsburgh because they lack good school choices, but because there are far fewer jobs for them in western Pennsylvania.
Thornburg lives in Philadelphia now, where he heads a government watchdog group. And the Philly metro region, he says, is just different.
The game for Philadelphia schools is to, frankly, attract the children of people who actually do have choices.
The region is growing, but unlike Pittsburgh, Philadelphia is its own county. So when people leave the city, they take a lot of their tax dollars with them. The key for Philadelphia is to stop wealth from fleeing for the burbs while giving poor families a ladder up.
So again, creating this sense that they have options here in Philadelphia, that if not the neighborhood school, then a magnet school or a charter school or a parochial school, I think adds to this sense that there's a future for them and their kids here, and that's a good thing.
He buys the idea that school choice has helped to stabilize Philadelphia.
But he's not convinced that if Pittsburgh had made the same moves at the same time, it would have changed the outcome. I'm Sarah Schneider.
And I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin, Keystone Crossroads.
The government recently announced that fertility rates in the United States are at record low levels. Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, to get a better understanding of how Americans feel about children.
Well, Frank, first up, to what extent do Americans still want to have children?
Yeah, that's a very important question. You know, if fundamentally people in their minds say no children are a bad idea, then clearly fertility is going to go down. But our data show that the norm in society that children are good still persists. We interviewed everybody and asked them about kids. We isolated people 40 and under who did not have children and say, do you want to have children? And that number, as it has been in the past, was up in the 80% range, 82% to be specific. So most people who don't have children and are under 40, still in rough childbearing years, say they would like to have children. And when we interview older people who didn't have children, not as high as 80%, but the majority of those people say, yes, looking back, I wish I had had children. So we clearly have a normative structure in society where having children is a positive, whether or not people are able to or finally end up actually having children.
And for those who want to have children, how many?
Well, that's an interesting question that we have been asking, believe it or not, going back for decades and decades and decades. We first asked, that is, Gallup first asked this in 1936, one of our original questions at Gallup, which was, what do you think is the ideal number of children for a family to have? Back then, even in the depths of the Depression, it was 3.6. Fast forward to today, and we have 2.7 as the mean. And that's actually slightly higher than it's been in the last several years. It fell below 3% way back in 1967, in part because Catholics quit saying that they wanted to have a lot of children, and it fell into the 2% range. But in the last several decades, we've been in and around 2.5 is the ideal family size. So even though the fertility rate is going down, as you said at the outset here, Dave, the perception of the ideal family size has not gone down. It's still about 2.5 kids.
Does Gallup probe why it's on the decline?
We don't ask those specific questions, Dave, but in talking to demographers, there are a number of reasons which have been given. And one of the reasons has to come back to Gallup data, which is, are you satisfied with the way things are going in this country, which has been low ever since the recession? Now, most demographers say that the recession, the economic hardship, did cause a decline in fertility. People put off having children because they're worried about having enough money in general. But that satisfaction level has not climbed back up. And one demographer I was interviewing says that she thinks that lack of positivity about the way society is going in general could have an impact on having children.
In 2018, to what extent is gender preference an issue?
We asked that question many, many years ago, and we started asking it again, and we still have a mild preference for boys over girls. And this is not a trivial issue because in many countries around the world, this preference for a boy baby is very, very significant. In 1941, 38% of Americans said they wanted a boy if they could only have one child, 24% a girl. The rest said it didn't matter. Fast forward to today, we just asked this. 36% of Americans say a boy, 28% of girls. Not that much different from what we found back way those many years ago in 1941.
Frank, let's take up a topic in the news, trade and tariffs.
We ask Americans what impact U.S. trade policies have on them personally, because one of President Trump's central themes is that trade policies are hurting Americans and hurting American workers, but we don't see it in the data. Let's take workers, for example. 57% say they don't know whether trade and tariffs helps or hurts their business, but of those who do have an opinion, it's 25 to 15 positive over negative. So clearly, no strong evidence from American workers of this nagging perception that trade and tariffs are really hurting them and their jobs.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
After this weekend, visitors to the Penn Museum in Philadelphia won't be seeing its ancient Sphinx for a while. The museum is about to undergo extensive renovations, expected to last several years. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports the Sphinx has been part of the life of the city for over a century.
The Sphinx of Ramses the Great had a full life before it arrived at a Philadelphia port in 1913. For more than 3,000 years, the red granite sculpture stood guard at an Egyptian temple. But immediately upon arrival here, the city adopted the 13-ton artifact as one of its own. The Sphinx now lives in the Lower Egyptian Gallery at the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. That's where people often stage their personal life moments, says associate curator Jennifer Wagner. That includes marriage proposals, weddings, and at least one funeral.
I think there's something about the way our Sphinx looks. I mean, he's sort of serene looking. He has this idea of eternity about him. You know, maybe if you're getting married, you want your married union to last as long as the Sphinx has lasted.
Beginning Monday, the Sphinx Hall will undergo a major renovation expected to take several years. Its massive Egyptian architectural elements will be reshuffled and reorganized. One of the most recent weddings to take place at the museum was on May 19th. That's when Jarsi Z and Parag Maharan were married in a kind of cross-cultural soup. The bride is Chinese, the groom Indian, both from Philadelphia, and Z gathered her guests at the feet of the ancient Egyptian Sphinx.
You know, we had Chinese, we had Indian, we had American, and then we have the Egyptian room. We just thought it was really cool to kind of have different parts of our wedding in these different spaces.
Hers may be one of the last weddings there. The details of the future space have not yet been finalized. When the gallery reopens in several years, the Sphinx may or may not be able to oversee such large events anymore. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's it for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Culinary. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanichevsky. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Nina Feldman for NewsWorks Tonight.